Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Thursday, March 28th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 822. Thank you, members, for hanging in there last night and showing up bright and early this morning. We do have several people signed up to testify on Senate Bill 822, but before we open it up for public testimony, I think I will ask our capable committee administrator, who's been working feverishly on this bill, to tell us what documents we have in front of us. And I think most of all of these documents that you'll be referring to are also listed on OLIS, correct?
I believe they are, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
What we just received this morning, so the latest copies before you, the large packet is a -2 amendment. And then we also received this morning the fiscal statement, to which I will refer when I read the staff measure summary. And I think those are the two newest documents. Everything else was given to us yesterday. The -2s, there's also a -1 that may be referred to today. That is on OLIS as well and available for public view.
And then it looks like our staff measure summary does not reflect this -2 amendment because we didn't have it in our possession.
Correct? That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. I do see that we have one of our colleagues in the room, and I know he was able to testify last night, but I will call Senator Knope forward so that he can give us his testimony and then get about his busy schedule.
Do you want me to read this over?
Yeah, and let's let our committee administrator tell us about the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 822 modifies the cost of living adjustment under the public employees retirement system. It specifies that the cost of living adjustment not exceed 1.5% to an allowance made on or after July 1st, 2013 and before July 1st, 2014. It delineates a graduated process for making the cost of living adjustment for years beginning July 1, 2014. Prohibits the Public Employees Retirement Board from paying an increased retirement benefit resulting from state income taxation of payments made by board if the person receiving the payments does not pay Oregon income tax on the benefits. Removes the limitations on the prohibition relating to the date of a retirement. It imposes similar prohibition for certain public employers that provide retirement benefits for police officers and firefighters other than by participation in the public employees retirement system. It directs the Public Employees Retirement Board to recalculate employer contribution rates to reflect savings attributable to ACT. Provides for expedited review by the Supreme Court upon petition by adversely affected party. It declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. There's no revenue impact. The fiscal statement issued we received this morning, and it is attached to your documents. There is a subsequent referral to Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Great. Thank you, Lori. And good morning, Senator Knope.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
I know that you've had a lot of time overnight to think about Senate Bill 822, so we're eagerly looking forward to your thoughts this morning.
I knew you would be. State Senator Tim Knope from State Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. Thank you, committee members, for hearing Senate Bill 822. As you know, the success of this session rests on what we do as it relates to PERS. Everybody in this building has an element of PERS, some sort of PERS fixes or reforms in their budgets. I represent the Republican caucus here today in asking you to improve Senate Bill 822, and would like you to consider the -2 amendments. And I mentioned these yesterday, and I won't go back through all the nine elements of them unless you would like me to, but I do want to just focus on the main element, which is actually similar to the one that's in 822, and it is the COLA, the cost of living adjustment, and just go back over those numbers where we start at 1.5% COLA for the first $24,000, and it's actually 0.4%, just a little less than half a percent for $24,001 through $36,000, and then 0.1% on everything above $36,000. And as you can see, we've been substantially progressive in the way we've dealt with the COLA. We recognize that if the COLA adjustment is going to be upheld, that we believe it could be upheld at the level of your bill or the level of our bill. based on the same theory. And as I listened to the testimony yesterday, colleagues, I don't want people to get strunk drunk. Now, you've heard of punch drunk. Strunk drunk is a condition whereby you, after listening to many attorneys on this issue, you become intoxicated with the idea that you can't make any changes at all to PERS. And in fact, strunk, I think, allowed for many potential changes to the PERS system. And I understand that this bill may end up in Ways and Means, and as a very wise person said, let's give the Ways and Means Committee all the ways and all the means to deal with this issue. And I believe that these Dash 2 amendments give you that opportunity. The Dash 1s are the Oregon School Boards Association amendments, and we have pledged to the good Senate President 14 votes for that plan, but we currently have no votes in our caucus for 822 as it stands. So we would encourage you to consider to improve upon it. And as I said yesterday, our goal really was to be inclusive and including as many elements of the different plans as that we could come up with to give really all the options out there, because it's my belief that we should ask the courts to answer all the questions and not just present them, you know, one at a time, one a session. If we're going to do this, I think we just need to do it and get it done, answer all the questions, and then we'll know, the people of Oregon will know, local districts will know, school boards will know what needs to happen. And again, this is a $2 billion problem, and I think we need to get as far down the road as we can. And the Republican caucus has said that $1.9 billion is where we think we need to be, but we're not tied to any direct elements of the nine elements of the plan as long as we can achieve the savings. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.
And I thank you very much. Senator Knopp will certainly take questions. I'm a little confused when you talked about the spirit of inclusiveness, because I'm looking at these. Are you talking about the Dash 2 amendments this morning? Or
I am.
It looks like they were dated yesterday. We did not get them in our possession until, I didn't see them until I walked into the hearing room this morning.
Yeah, well, they were, Madam Chair, they were hot off the press yesterday, and we were, as you know, the hearing came up rather suddenly, so we didn't know what vehicle was going to be used. So we worked to include the elements of as many of the PERS bills as we can, and thank you, by the way, to Legislative Council for getting those out to us. But we were working, obviously, to read through those Dash 2 amendments to make sure that they actually did what we thought they would do. And we believe that they're pretty accurate as to what we want as to the 9 points that we try to include in the plan themselves.
And so they are similar to Senate Bill 754, plus they have additional features in them, is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Senator Knopp?
I have just one.
Yes, go ahead, Senator Starr.
I love this chart, and I'm going to refer to this chart. Anytime that I talk about PERS in the public or with my colleagues, but this is the chart we got yesterday from Mr. Cleary, and the arcs of these of the graphs are significant in that it tells us how much employers are going to have to, how, what the cost of the system is going to be for the state and for taxpayers. So based on the Dash 2 amendments, what do you think the arc of the chart would be if we were to adopt the Dash 2 amendments and it were to become law? It would be a guess to a certain extent because we haven't done the analysis, but
it would be, Madam Chair and Senator Starr. We have preliminary numbers on ours, but we don't have the official numbers from PERS, and so I would rather wait. But what I can tell you as it relates to the current bill you have before you and the Dash 2s, that you would substantially, the Dash 2s would bend that number substantially much more than the current bill, which I believe took it from about 25% of payroll down to the rate, down to about 22.5%. And unfortunately, that still causes, I think, great jeopardy for school districts, my school district, and local governments. And, you know, I would just say that in 2003, when I left this building, I indicated that there would likely need to be more reforms made. And if the courts had given us everything that we'd asked for then, we wouldn't be where we are today. And now we're really having to answer, I believe, all the rest of the questions, and quite frankly, have had to be much more thoughtful and creative about how we go about trying to fix this system and make it sustainable and make it affordable and ultimately make it fair for everyone. And I recognize that fair is going to be in the eye of the beholder and maybe, quite frankly, the account holder. But ultimately, if we don't fix this problem, we have serious problems with our budget and with the services that we can offer going forward.
Okay. Any other questions for Senator Knope? Okay. Thank you very
much.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Okay. We are in a public hearing, members, and we do have several people signed up to testify, and so I think I will just call them in the order that they have signed up, and we'll start with Brian DeLashmet, Rick Bennett, and Peg. Good morning. I see Rick Bennett is back, and we want to thank you for deferring till this morning because we were here pretty late in the evening yesterday so that we could hear from everybody else who had signed up. So whichever of you would like to go first, please go ahead.
For the record, I'm Brian DeLashmet. I represent the Oregon Nurses Association, the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Oregon State Police Officers Association, Troopers, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. So as you can see, out of my 8 clients, 5 of them have a direct interest in this issue. As many of you know, I've been in the building 36 plus years, so I've got some history on the building and also on PERS issues. But the one thing that I thought was missing yesterday in the whole discussion about PERS and the impact of COLA is to go back and look at the history and what impact the COLA has had in the past on retirees. And so what I'm handing out now is I asked PERS for some information on what buying power we have based upon COLAs going backwards. So we really have an idea of what impact any changes to the COLA going forward. So as those get passed out, there's actually 2 sheets. The first one, and I've actually highlighted on the first sheet, is a part of a report from Milliman, which is the firm
sure.
that advises PERS, and I asked for this data. And if you look at years retired in the first column there, and you look at like 1980, buying power in 2012 of those retired in 1980 is 76.5% of what they retired on. That's not 76.5% of their final average salary. That's the buying power based upon whatever they retired on. And so you can go all the way forward and look that even with the 2% COLA, I know I listened to the testimony yesterday, but there was one gentleman that talked about inflation being roughly 3% over at the time, and the 2% COLA really didn't keep us up. This is probably as dramatic a chart as you can see as to what really happens with a COLA that doesn't keep even up with CPI over time. The second sheet, just so that there's no misunderstanding, is the averages of monthly benefits of retirees given some different time periods, 1980, 85 to 89, so forth. And I highlighted in that, obviously, in 1980, we're talking, after 30 years of service, we're talking about $1,400. So if you combine those kinds of numbers with the lack of or degeneration of buying power over time, you see that the CPI and the COLA that we were really talking about have not kept up. We have over the past actually talked about ad hoc increases in COLA because we have people who have retired at certain points going back 15, 20, 25 years when we had hyperinflation that actually their buying power has degenerated to the point where they actually have to have public assistance. Commenting on a couple of the things that were talked about yesterday, and I won't spend a lot of time on it, but the term indexing came up. Obviously, and I'll use a phrase that somebody else used, this is the best bill of the bad bills. But without indexing and then without consideration of the COLA somehow being coordinated with the CPI, people continue to lose over time. The next thing that I'd like to talk a little bit about is legal costs. I want to caution you, and obviously being in the building during the changes in 96 and 2003, I was keenly aware of the discussion, the legal discussion on whether this is legal, whether that's legal, and so forth. But the end result is, and I want to make this point right on the button, is that whenever we get into legal litigation, it's not the state of Oregon that pays for the defense of the changes that you make. It's the PERS funds themselves. And the money in the PERS funds is money that's supposed to be paid out in benefits to PERS retirees. So what you have is a situation in which the PERS Coalition, which is that group that represents the PERS employees, have to hire an attorney to fight against PERS, which is their own money as well. So we're paying twice for any litigation. So again, I want you to think through that it's not the general fund of the state that deals with the litigation costs. It's the PERS retirees and the PERS funds themselves. Let me make a little bit of a kind of a rhetorical question, but what kind of a state have we become when public service is no longer attractive? Let me give you some examples. I've heard state troopers that I represent talk about 20 years ago when they entered the service of state police. There was 5,000 applicants for 40 positions. 5,000 applicants for 40 positions. Currently, the state police puts out a bulletin seeking applicants for any vacant slots, and they've had a lot of retirees, and they're going to have a lot more. And they have a hard time filling those available slots based upon two factors. And I think one is the general attack on public employees and PERS. And the other, obviously, is that public service in itself is not as attractive, even in a down economic times. We've got high unemployment, but yet people don't want to enter public service. And I think, to me, that kind of drove the point home that public service, even the best of the best in state as far as state troopers, is not attractive anymore.
And, Brian, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're not using the big timer as we did last night, but we
I'm just about to wrap. I'm just
okay,
about
so
to
if
wrap
you could
up.
Just bring us to your conclusions.
Again, in wrapping up, you know, being in the building a long time, I've seen a transition that's occurred. And I think it's unfortunate that a lot of the testimony yesterday was about pitting schools against other services, troopers, DD services, so forth. I guess my observation of being in the building a long time, it's really unfortunate that we've gotten to the situation where it's either this or that. And I think this PERS discussion that we're in right now has kind of really brought that to the forefront. Obviously, I hope there's other solutions. I can feel the train pulling out of the tracks on PERS, as I did in 2003 and 96. But some of the suggestions, whether it's indexing, dealing with CPI and the COLA in a way that means buying power doesn't go away, would be very much appreciated. With that, I want to show you my AARP card. My dear friend here is going to follow me, but he's always gotten my back, and that's why I just soon come up with him. Thank you, and I'm open to any questions.
Great. I think we'll hear from the whole panel before we open it up for questions.
Senate President Courtney, Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Farioli, I want to thank you for coming and listening this morning. My name is Pig, and just for the record, I will state that is my legal name. I think I am a PERS retiree. I am a member of AFSCME. I am a 30-plus year state worker. And I think that a lot of the folks that testified yesterday did a great job of putting the human face on what you're asking PERS retirees to face. I want to talk more about the fact that we have a funding problem. It's not a problem that you created. It's not a problem we created. We all acknowledge that. And the issue is the unfunded actuarial liability, that the PERS costs keep rising and that we ask public employers to meet those rising costs. And yet the problem came because we couldn't get investment returns. So I would ask you to please look at other ways to fund than just on the backs of retirees. I have been retired 9 years. I now make $50 a month more than when I retired. I pay a home mortgage. I make car payments. I have health problems. I make massive insurance premium payments and health care out-of-pocket payments. So if you're going to take this money from retirees, which I agree, I think I see the train pulling out of the station, would you do us a favor and build into the law accountability for where that money goes? Does it actually pay down the unfunded actuarial liability? Does it go straight to the schools? If it does it go into the classrooms? I have nieces and nephews who are in public schools, and I would love to see them get a great education. I get frustrated when I see administration growing and growing and classroom sizes growing right along with it. So if you're going to take the money from me, let's make the law include accountability for where that money goes. I would really appreciate that. Bottom line, I feel it is unfair that we are pitting some public servants against some public services. That's my perspective. What we have is a revenue problem, and I ask that you look at it that way and try to seek funding elsewhere where you can. Take as little from us as possible. We have paid a lot. And I thank you for your time and your attention, and of course would delightedly answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. Here today testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 822. Our public policy states that state and local retirement systems should provide annual, automatic, and full cost of living adjustments based on an accurate inflation index. And sections 1 through 10 of Senate Bill 822 are in conflict with that policy. Our focus primarily is related to current retirees and those who are near retirement. Because of that, they have very limited opportunity to pivot their retirement strategies. And as Brian mentioned, over time, the COLA or the limiting of the COLA impacts their the purchasing power of their defined benefit. And over time, certainly middle-class retirees will be struggling to meet their basic needs in their advanced years. And I have provided written testimony, and all that is clearly there. I think I would like to take an opportunity while I'm before you, though, to speak a little bit more to one point that Brian made. And this is I think it's very unfortunate the governor and the co-chairs and others have chosen to frame this issue as a kids versus retirees. A false notion that generations are in conflict gives a distorted view of how families actually work and greatly underestimates the bonds that actually exist between young and old. In the real world, families prosper and struggle together so that all generations can succeed. They are family members who depend on each other. They are Argonians at different stages in their life's journey. One day, young will be old, and they will need retirement security of pensions and Social Security and Medicare every bit as much as our older citizens do today. The policies that hurt older people are in no way a help to younger people. We should be working together to solve real problems that affect everyone. We should be working together to make sure people of all ages have the support they need to thrive. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Yes, Senator Starr.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. First of all, this biennium, we've got 10% more revenue than we've had in previous biennium, $1.7 billion. And while we talk a lot about K-12 education and kids, we've got Department of Human Services, we've got corrections, we've got cities and counties that are looking at, and school districts that are looking at astronomical rates. And I can show you the chart again that proves it. This is not just about kids. It's about supplying public services across the board and being able to figure out how we can afford to do that where our budgets aren't just completely being eaten up by this cost of this system. So while I appreciate this, the kids versus retirees, it's much broader than that. And and the long-term implications are things that we have to think about. Well, Senate Bill 822, and I think the primary reason that Republicans have a problem with that bill is that all it does is kind of kick the can down the road. It creates a short-term solution, budget solution, but it doesn't deal with the long-term problem. The long-term problem is, you know, a 20-year problem. And we have to solve that. And that's not raising taxes. Raising taxes isn't going to deal with the cost to the system for the state and all the way through the process. I haven't heard a solution other than, well, we need to raise taxes. Well, the co-chair's plan has taxes included in it. That shared sacrifice is in the co-chair's plan. And yet we still are faced with, in the long term, rates that are unsustainable. Purely unsustainable.
Madam Chair.
If you wish to respond, you can.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, let me respond in a couple of ways. With regard to shared sacrifice, I would note, in addition to this bill, the co-chair's budget seeks a targeted reduction in health services of $135 million. Also targeted within that is $22 to $25 million directly related in reductions to seniors and people with disabilities. When you consider the matching federal funds with that, you're talking about a reduction of probably $75 million in essential services to seniors. I would make note that the response by the Republican caucuses to the co-chair's budget calls for an additional $200 million reduction in health services. I have to assume, without any other detail, that senior services would be significantly reduced, and partly we're talking about reductions of $150 to $200 million in senior services. I would also make mention that when we talk about tax expenditures, the only thing we seem to be able to think of is a senior medical deduction. Out of 270-odd corporate and personal tax expenditures, that's the only one that anybody seems to actually be able to recall. I would suggest that some of you have a rather distorted view of what shared sacrifice is. I would also say that when we talk about government living within its means, all we seem to be able to think about is the spending side of that. The reality is tax revenue, our structure, and the rates that we pay generate revenue that is spent in two ways, both in direct services and in tax expenditures. And when we talk about saying we don't have enough to adequately fund education or public safety or human services, I'd like somebody to also say we can't afford all the tax breaks we provide corporations and individuals in this state. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for these good folks? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And next I'll call Scott Winkles and Sean O'Day. Good morning, and as you heard me say earlier, we're not using the big timer, the one that's going to turn off your microphones, but we are on somewhat of a schedule. So if you could please summarize your testimony, that would be great.
I will do my best. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. With me today is the League's General Counsel, Sean O'Day, to talk about a document that's being passed around now.
Do we have this, actually? I'll ask our committee administrator. Is this available to the people that are listening to the hearing or not?
what's being distributed right now, Madam Chair. Yes, it can be scanned and put in electronically.
Madam Chair, I had committee services do that.
Perfect.
So, for the record, I would also just like to say I have the I don't envy you your task. I don't think there's any easy decision here. And, I wish you the best in making this difficult decision. I was looking at the studying this bill as soon as it came out, and I think our position on it is somewhat complicated. I think, yes, the League recognizes that a COLA cap is part of a overall PERS. I don't know if solution is the right word, but a way to mitigate these rate increases. When looking at how to articulate how these rate increases are impacting cities, I was having a difficult time coming up with some quantifiables. I could talk about the police officer per thousand ratio in Eugene being an anemic 1.15. This is a service level that's not acceptable by any stretch of the imagination. We can talk about library closures. We can talk about the losses in other services. But I think Senator Starr really hit on it when he talked about a 20-year amortization. It's not just this next biennium we're impacted by. Our rates are going to go up in the following biennium again, according to PERS, to about 25% for the state and local government pool. And this is the rate we are going to experience for the foreseeable future. This is 20 years of added costs of a 25% of total payroll impact on local government budgets. This translates into 20 years of service cuts and diminished service levels. We need to move forward. We think this is 822 is a reasonable starting point. We think that there are some very good aspects to that, but there's more that we can do. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. O'Day.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Sean O'Day, the General Counsel for the League of Oregon Cities. I'm here this morning on behalf of the League to testify in favor of Senate Bill 822. Specifically, I'm here to answer any questions that you might have about some legal analysis that the League had asked Mr. Michael Gillette to do, the document that Mr. Winkles was referring to just a moment ago. Let me know at the outset that Mr. Gillette wished that he could have been here in person this morning. However, unfortunately, he had a prior commitment serving in a pro tem capacity before the Multnomah Circuit Court. However, as the attorney who requested his advice and as someone who's had the benefit of discussing these matters with him, I'll do my best to fill in for him. Although obvious, I want to reiterate something that Senator Devlin said yesterday. That is, words to the effect that it will be ultimately the courts that determine the constitutionality of the laws of this state, to which I would add, and certainly not the attorneys who are testifying before the legislature today or in the future. And although it is the courts who ultimately determine the constitutionality, I do applaud the legislature for carefully examining the legal issues and taking seriously its responsibility to enact laws that are indeed constitutional. To that point, although the legal opinions on the constitutionality of any changes to our public retirement system are and will be varied, I submit that the legislature should take some comfort in that fact. It shows that the court's prior case law on the Contracts Clause has not clearly delineated the boundaries of the limitations that that clause places on the legislature's authority. Indeed, the court's own decisions on these matters have been marked by dissents, concurrences that show disagreements among members of the court on these issues as well. In other words, I believe it's difficult for any attorney to come before you and state that the law on these matters has clearly been settled. With that in mind, as to these specific reforms in Senate Bill 822, it is our view that the changes embodied in Senate Bill 822 are defensible against constitutional challenges. Specifically, in the court's previous holdings, it is stated, and some have said perhaps erroneously so, that a COLA was part of the legislative contract with public employees, thereby placing limits on the legislature's authority to remove the COLA. However, the court has yet to be asked whether the legislature can alter the method of calculation of that COLA. In our view, such alterations are permissible and defensible. Indeed, a COLA by its very nature is intended to be something that is adjusted over time to reflect changes in the cost of living. I think Mr. Gillette puts it best in his letter that you now have before you when he states that after a review of the relevant case law, such changes may be permissible because the amount of the COLA is a flexible detail that is part of the PERS contract, not an immutable characteristic of it. With that, I will close my testimony and be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Yes, Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Mr. Winkles. Does the association have any other approaches, additional concepts, or suggested amendments for Senate Bill 822?
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Farrioli, yes, we do. There, when looking at the $14 billion deficit, there's really only so many places where you can find significant savings, and one of those is the COLA, at which H-22 begins to address. One of the other places to look for the significant savings is in the money match calculation, and that's the also the annuity system with retirement. So what we have. So what we have in the works right now is an amendment to the bill that would remove the money match calculation from the people who have left public service. So those are people who chose to leave public service, either quit or made a decision that caused them to, shall we say, leave without a party. Their employment, and we would still leave those people able to have the full formula calculation, or they could take their lump sum, but they would not be eligible for the money match calculation. And so, removing, according to the Mercer analysis, I'm sorry, the Milliman analysis on the potential savings, this would be save somewhere in the neighborhood of $442 million if the inactive members did not have access to the money match calculation. And so that's one of the areas where we think this bill could be improved.
Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to be clear, you're talking about people who were in PERS, quit, and left their money there but have not yet retired?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer, correct.
So and to be clear, you're not talking about people who have retired under that process?
Senator Rosenbaum, Chair Beyer, correct.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Are you aware of any legal analysis on that proposal?
Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, Justice Gillette is working on some additional analysis as well, but the amendment is in the drafting.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I did actually want to ask Mr. O'Day a question because I'm reading again this document that you submitted this morning, which has been floating around, I think, since for about a month or so. But it appears to be a comparison between our advice from our lawyers, legislative counsel, and a memo from the Department of Justice, the concluding paragraph of which says both arguments or both opinions are well thought out and have legal merit. Is that your conclusion from reading this advice?
Chair Rosenbaum, the members of the committee, what we had asked Mr. Gillette to do is do an analysis of the case law and give us an idea of what the likelihood of any sort of reforms would be within the courts. We then, in light of that analysis, asked him to take a look at the two opinions that were floating. And I believe what he essentially states in this letter is that the legislative counsel's opinion is certainly a plausible reading of the case law, but is not the one that he thinks would carry the day. He believes that the DOJ analysis is more persuasive and is one that would result in these reforms being held constitutional and did I answer your question?
I'm looking, actually, I don't see these, well, I guess these numbers, these pages are numbered on page 2 at the statement in the first paragraph that in some respects the strength decision was wrongly decided, and also saying that part of the analysis from the DOJ makes a difficult argument even though it may be intellectually justifiable. He seems to be saying that, and I'm sure any former Supreme Court justice would probably agree with this, that these matters would have to be fully analyzed and briefed and argued before an appellate court, before anyone with any certainty could say who would prevail.
Absolutely. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, that is absolutely right, which is why I stated earlier that no attorney can really come before you today and tell you that these are clearly defensible or that they're clearly non-starters with the court. And I think that Mr. Gillette's memorandum really highlights that, that Ledge Counsel has one reading of the case law. It is a plausible, defensible reading of the case law. However, it is not the only reading of the case law, and that with fuller briefing and perhaps a reexamination of some of the principles, they're outlined in Strunk. The changes that are before you clearly could be upheld by a court. There are arguments to support that.
And lots of lawyers to make them, too.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you both for your
Thank
testimony.
You.
And I think we have one more person signed up to testify, and that is Arthur Towers. If you'd like to come forward. And that this actually completes our sign-up sheet. So if there was someone here under public testimony, I don't see them. So good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers. I'm the political director for Service Employees Union, Local 503. And I'm proud to represent our membership, about half of whom are participants and the other half that are not. Very proud to represent the members who spoke last night. They can address this issue much more eloquently than I can. But I did want to amplify one point that was, I think, missed last night that Mr. DeLashmut actually talked to, and that is the impact of Senate Bill 822 on those later in life. That over the course of time, the impact of the COLA cap is going to be pretty substantial, even for moderate income retirees. I know that a lot of committee members and a lot of legislators have expressed a great deal of concern about protecting the interests of moderate income retirees, and we're trying to find a fair way to move forward. And I just want to point out that you don't have to get very far above $30,000 a year in pension benefit before you start to see really dramatic double-digit increases if you live into your 80s. And as people live longer in retirement, I'm very, very concerned that we're looking at moving more and more seniors into poverty. And I believe that the other piece that I wanted to touch on that didn't really get touched on is that the statistics show that women are more greatly impacted by poverty in their retirement years, and more of our members are women than men among those who are in the pension system. And so I just wanted to flag that as a concern as well. With that, I will conclude my testimony, I believe, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Any questions for this witness? I don't see any. Thank you very much being here today. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 822? Okay, seeing no one, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 822 and open a work session on Senate Bill 822.
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
I appreciate the public hearing. I appreciate all the testimony. I appreciate the information that we've learned in the, you know, what, 4 hours, 4.5 hours of hearing. It's clear to me that we need to do more than what Senate Bill 822 contemplates. And to that end, I'd move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 822.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 822. This is a pretty voluminous amendment that has just been distributed to members this morning. I myself have not read it, but we have heard testimony on it. And to your motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just outline quickly 9 elements that are in the Dash 2 amendments. These are issues or items that Senator Canope addressed last evening in his testimony and briefly commented on this morning. It eliminates the tax remedy payment for non-Oregonians, limits the cost of living adjustments, redirects 6% Tier 1 and Tier 2 member contributions from the IAP to separate accounts, reduces the money match annuity rate, removes overtime, unused vacation, paid leave from calculation for final average salary, removes overtime from the calculation of final average salary for OPSERP beginning on January 1 of 2014, allows employers to negotiate a pickup lower than 6%, adds a new 2% in contribution requirement, and lastly, it also removes legislators from PERS. This is a pretty broad menu of options, and as Senator Knope mentioned, providing, as this bill is going to Ways and Means, providing the members of Ways and Means as many ways and as many means as possible to address this issue. This provides a lot of options as opposed to the base bill that provides a narrow number of options and really doesn't address the long-term challenges that PERS has or PERS causes on public budgets across Oregon, and public agencies, cities, counties, school districts, special districts that have PERS members, let alone the budgets that we have to address here in this building. The challenge we face is not a 2-year challenge. It's a 20, 30, maybe 40-year challenge of lowering the rates so that this system can be sustainable for the long term. And you know, it's difficult. There's no question. It's difficult to address this issue. But if we're going to address it, let's solve it. And that's the purpose of the Dash 2 amendments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, any further discussion on the amendment? Okay, Mike, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Burdick?
No.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
No. And the motion fails. And we are in a work session. Senator Burdick?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 822 with the due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Senator Burdick has moved Senate Bill 822 with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion on the motion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
I understand the situation that this legislature has faced, and I understand the challenges that the co-chairs are facing as they work to find consensus on balancing a budget. I would say that, you know, we don't have the information back from PERS on exactly what this measure does. And quite honestly, Madam Chair, I've never seen in my time in the legislature a fiscal impact statement that says further analysis required on it. I've been around a long time, and I don't think I've ever seen this, that we have a fiscal impact statement that has that statement clearly printed here. So we're moving a bill as a policy committee down to Ways and Means where we don't have all the information, all the data. That concerns me, but I understand the process here, and I will be a no vote on the motion.
Thank you, Senator Starr. And I do see Paul Cleary in the room. I think I'll ask him to come forward at this point. I did want to actually clarify something for Senator Starr and others who may be listening, that those words further analysis required are appearing on many, many fiscal impact statements on bills with subsequent referrals to Ways and Means. I don't know whether that's something new that LFO has been putting that language on bills, but these preliminary fiscals for bills that have subsequent referrals are quite commonplace in the session. You may not have seen them before, but I can tell you I have seen them on other bills, so it's not unusual. And I see that Paul Cleary is back with us, and thank you for working so hard overnight.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Cleary, Executive Director of PERS. As I indicated yesterday, we were waiting on the formal actuarial analysis on Senate Bill 822. We didn't think we were going to get it until noon. came in when I was walking into the building, so I had these copies printed off at the treasurer's office. And I'll just direct your attention to page 2 of the bill of the letter from Milliman. And the first numbers that you see about two-thirds of the way down the letter, I'll explain those to you. What this analysis indicates is that under Senate Bill 822, our total liabilities would decrease by $3.2 billion. Our accrued liabilities, in other words, our unfunded liabilities right now, would decrease by $2.6 billion. The impact on rates would be a 0.3% decrease in our normal cost rate, a 2.2% decrease in our unfunded actuarial liability rate, for a total rate decrease of 2.5%, the number that I shared with you yesterday. If you apply that 2.5% rate reduction to our total payroll projection for all PERS covered employment during the biennium 13-15, we project that payroll will equal about $18.4 billion. This is across all 900 employers. That equals savings of $460 million. If you then grow that payroll at our normal assumption, which over time has proven out to be pretty accurate, and that's 3.75% a year, in the 15-17 biennium, a 2.5% rate reduction would equal $496 million. So the numbers that I was able to share with you verbally yesterday have been confirmed in this. It's just when you ask your actuaries to do something and put it on the record, they're going to go through all the caveats and everything else, and I just wanted to share this letter with you. We will get this. I think we sent it electronically just as we were walking in as well to LFO, and we'll get this posted up on our website, and we'll send it electronically to you, so Lori, so you can get it posted as well. And I'm sorry that it took us a while, but you know, we had to actually evaluate the bill, and we just got it on Monday, and so glad to share this with you.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Cleary. And I am also looking back at the preliminary fiscal that we did get, which refers to other assumed savings, such as a $350 million amount in one-time savings for the 13-15 biennium. I think those are changes that are contemplated by the co-chairs of Ways and Means, and they are reflected in the fiscal impact statement. Is that right?
Chair Rosenbaum, yeah, that would be the anticipated budget note that would come with this bill that would direct the board to apply a 3% hard rate collar for this biennia, which would reshape our current funding. Remember, we got to go up by about 7%. Right now we're scheduled to go up 5 this year and 2 5 this biennia and 2 next biennia. That would make it into a 3-3-3-4 shaping. So, and that's, I'll use the word savings. I'll put quotes around that, though, for the audience, because it's really just shaping the funding. We still get to the same cruising altitude as Senator Starr noted. We just climb at a different rate.
Thank you, Mr. Cleary. Is there further discussion on the motion?
Madam Chairman, after the vote, I'll have a statement, if you don't mind.
That's up to you, Senator Farioli.
Actually, Madam Chairman, it's up to you. But thank you.
So I want to just say that I think today is a step of a process. And for those who think that this bill does not represent a serious proposal for changes to PERS, I would just say to them that the savings in this proposal in the 13-15 biennium, which equate to $805 million, are definitely a serious proposal. I think the work that has gone into putting these PERS changes in the context of the overall budget has been painstaking, tedious, and agonizing for the sponsors of this bill. And I know them well, and I know that this is not work that they take lightly, either from a technical standpoint or from a fairness standpoint. So I think that this bill does belong in the Ways and Means Committee because it is the most serious proposal that I have seen. Having said that, I also want to say that I listened very, very carefully to the over three hours of testimony that we took last night and the testimony this morning. And I have no doubt that for the people affected by this bill, whether they're current retirees or current employees of state and local government and other government entities, that this will seem like an incredibly painful slap in the face to them. And I know that the sacrifices that people are making every day when they come to work, whether they're teachers, whether they're frontline social workers, whether they're the people down the street at the state hospital or down the street at the prison, are doing some of the hardest, most dangerous jobs that I don't think most Oregonians would gladly volunteer to step in and trade places. So I fully hear that these are changes that people see as not fair to them. I think that this bill does belong in the Ways and Means process as part of the budget process. I think there are other changes that need to be made this session so that we do see that we're balancing the budget not on the backs of one group of people alone, but that we are also looking at the overall fairness and being good stewards of the tax dollars that we were elected to represent. I think people expect us to make sure that government is run efficiently, that our revenue system is one that is using tax dollars in the ways that they were meant, and that is why I think this bill belongs in the Ways and Means process, and I will be voting to send it there today. Okay, seeing no further discussion, Mike, would you please call the roll on the motion?
Senator Beyer?
Yes.
Senator Burdick?
Yes.
Senator Starr?
No.
Vice Chair Farioli?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. And the motion carries. And I will close the work session. Oh, you wish to stay in the work session?
The work session can close, Madam Chair.
I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 822. And Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I want to acknowledge some of the things that we heard in the testimony and also to thank the co-chairs for a lot of hard work that they've done to try to get us to a place where we can have more thorough discussions. And I want to point out that there have been unprecedented discussions between caucuses, sharing information, a lot of outreach in both directions in the Senate for sure, and I think those are going to continue with House and Senate leadership. Those discussions have to occur, and they will. The testimony that I heard over the last couple days, Madam Chairman, I want to compliment you on the way you handled those hearings. It was very emotional testimony. It reminded me a lot of the testimony that we heard during the dislocations that we see still ongoing in timber-dependent communities about the losses and the pain that we heard. But what I heard is that folks want us to look at tax expenditure limitations. They want us to look at additional revenue. They want us to look at reductions in spending. And they want us to look at cost containment in a more balanced way. And I will tell you, Madam Chair, that there will be tax expenditure limitations, and there will be additional revenue, and there will be reductions in spending, and there will be cost containment. And those things will be supported by Senate Republicans and others in this building. We need to get a much more comprehensive solution to this problem, and Madam Chairman, we are proposing exactly the kind of solutions that we heard outlined in these hearings in the last 2 days. So I want to thank you again, Madam Chair, for what I consider to be painful but very necessary hearings, and you've done a wonderful job, in my opinion, as did the joint chairs yesterday at our hearing. So thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to make the statement.
Thank you, Senator Farioli, for your comments. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I voted this morning to move the bill forward because it needed to be moved forward in the Ways and Means. We've got a serious problem that needs to be addressed, and I think the two co-chairs have done a marvelous job of trying to find a solution to that problem, and I know they'll continue working on it. There are really two issues that we're trying to deal with. One of them is the economic issue, which we've heard a lot of discussion about, and the other one is a legal question. The economic issue is real to me, and I think there are different ways to, as they say, skin the cat, and this is one way to get there. The legal issue, I think, is still out. I haven't made up my mind on that one, but I have serious questions about the constitutionality of touching the COLA at all. I just think that's there, and I'm still thinking about that, and we'll continue until we get something on the floor.
Thank you, Senator Beyer, for your comments. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to commend Senator Farioli for recognizing that this is a piece of what we need to do, and that our approach must be more comprehensive. We cannot balance this budget on the backs of anybody. It is truly is a shared sacrifice. And in my other job, I hope to be a constructive player and work with all parties to make sure that happens.
Thank you, Senator Burdick. Seeing no further comments, members with nothing further to come before us today, we are adjourned.